I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What's up, everybody? Thanks for joining me off the record once again. So you know how we do business up front. If you haven't already, subscribe on Acast or iTunes and go and check out the back catalog of the pod. There's a lot of cool stuff. We got Ricky Gervais, Scroobius Pip, two live Goldie joints waiting for you just there. My man Tim Latham, the international sound pip and badass producer Tribe, De La, and the fun-loving Criminals. We've also got New York Times bestselling author and bona fide badass Jen Sincero, as well as music legends like Arthur Baker, DJ Uncle Mike, and DJ Jai representing Brizzle. And a dude named Dana Brunetti. Now, he had a little show called House of Cards and some movies like 50 Shades of Grey and Captain Phillips. You might have heard of those. He's my man. He's a movie producer. Anyway, we got lots of good stuff for you to tune into, so make sure you do that. Okay, business first, party second. Let's do it like a mullet. On to my guest this week. I've worked with this guy on 5 seasons of the cult National Geographic show called Drugs, Inc. His name is Chris Lent. He's the British gent who finds his way into some of the most violent drug dealers, gang members, and hardened criminals' houses. He's the producer of a show that taught me more about drugs than being a rock star ever could. As the narrator of Drugs, Inc., I got the privilege of the inside scoop on some of the craziest shit that went down in the making of the show. And today, talking with Chris on the pod, I'm sure you can hear some of those stories coming out. Now, this is another one of those episodes where you're really going to get behind the scenes from someone you might not usually hear from, but who you definitely want to hear from. So check it out. My man, Chris Lent, producer of Drugs, Inc. on Huey Off the Record. So anyway, I'm here with my man Chris. But yeah, I'm at the offices. It's like a nice kind of conference room we're in, you know. And you showed me the picture of the Commandante with his mask on. Now, how long did we work together? Like 4 years?
I think a bit longer actually. Yeah. I think maybe around 5, 6. Drugs Inc. Ran for 2009, 2017, 8 years, and you came in season 3?
Yeah, season 3, yeah.
Yeah, so it's got to be at least 5 years, maybe 5, 6 years.
Now, going back, because I don't really know the whole story, how did Drugs, Inc. start? Like, how did it get, I mean, if someone's idea to go, hey, let's talk to drug dealers or something, yeah. Right?
Well, we started off, we were making shows for National Geographic that looked slightly more historically. They were more retrospective stories, and we were looking at sort of organized crime histories of major American cities. Mm-hmm. And then we moved on to work with doing a similar treatment, working with outlaw motorcycle clubs. That was a series called Outlaw Bikers.
And those are the Russian dudes as well, right? Weren't there some crazy Russian bikers?
We didn't get onto the Russians, yeah. So we were sticking primarily to what's called the Big Five in the United States, so obvious names. Mm-hmm. But the stories were both sides. They usually focused around sort of undercover operations that ATF mounted against these clubs, but we would tell the story from both sides, and they were retrospective. And then my boss, who's not here anymore, he moved on to greater things with another company. But he came up with the idea, actually, of why don't we apply this treatment of getting guys to talk to us and tell us stuff but make it in the moment, present tense, and also let's look at the drug trade.
Wow.
And I think he'd read a book about the sort of history of cocaine, which struck a chord with him, and he thought, well, could we take elements of this and broaden it? So the idea was, we had no idea whether we could get people to talk to us.
Yeah, because that's the trick, isn't it, to get anybody to talk to you?
It's true, but I mean, we'd had some success, you know, reaching out to, as I say, the biker clubs and also to former mobsters and so on in these other organised crime shows that we were doing, which is a series called Underworld Cities. We'd had some success, but they're all retrospective, so these guys have done their time.
Yeah.
Maybe they've written a book, you know, or they've had a movie made about their life.
Statute of limitations. Yeah.
There's all that too. Yeah. So it wasn't... It was the same deal as actually going and being with them while they're doing it. And
excuse me while I shoot this guy.
So anyway, we put it together and we managed to get Nat Geo to go along with it. The first couple of series, the idea was you took a different drug, you know, cocaine or heroin or, you know, meth or whatever, and you made a film about the supply chain, essentially. Mm. And it was a number of discrete portraits of people who are along that supply chain. They don't know each other, but they all have something in common.
Mm.
So whether it's the producer, you know, the opium farmer, the poppy farmer in Afghanistan, or the guy trafficking the drugs, or customs or police who are trying to stop the drugs, or the paramedics who are picking up the pieces, the users, and of course the dealers and the distributors and what have you as well. You know, so that you got a sort of, you didn't get a sort of linear story, or it goes from here to here, you know, make it like this, they move it here, they move it there, cops try and stop them here, etc. What you got was a number of portraits, which reflected, as it were, the human condition.
Yeah.
And these people are all involved in some way. They may have very different takes on the drug and what they think of it, and they're all involved for different reasons, but they're all touched by it. That was the first two seasons. And then we realized we were starting to run out of drugs.
Yeah, if you're doing it, I guess if you're doing like heroin, cocaine, meth, pot, you know, you kind of run out, you know. But I remember, I mean, yeah, just tell me the story, because there's someone, we got the crocodile at one point. I was like, what the fuck is this? It's crazy. But yeah.
Yeah, well, we did revisit, because obviously when we were around long enough that you could then revisit some of the drugs, which we did do, because there was a big change. I mean, heroin particularly, as you know, in the United States, it's a huge, you know, when we started in 2009, it was a problem, but it was essentially a sort of needle-based street drug, kind of bottom of the chain, you know, people didn't take it for fun, it was, you know, etc. And in the course of about 4 years, it not only exploded, but the cartels sort of cynically rebranded it as a cool recreational drug aimed at young people that you could smoke or snort, you know, and it's no longer a needle.
Heroin is just not for, it's not for booting anymore, right? No,
yeah.
Wow.
So we were able to revisit that and some of the other drugs also. But initially we ran out of, after about 12 different drugs, we were getting down to very, you know, quite esoteric drugs like GHB, which is a club drug, and you know, not hugely widely used in some pockets.
Yeah, it's sort of a workout drug or something.
It's
too?
Initially a workout drug. Exactly.
I don't know much. You're the guy asking about drugs. What does GHB do?
Well, if you take a little bit of it, it's a stimulant. It's
oh, okay.
If you take a lot of it, it's like ketamine, and it will just knock you sideways, you know, into oblivion. So you've got to get the balance just right, which ketamine is the same really, in that way. So you can use it in a club context, but just don't overdo it, because then you hit the K-hole. So GHB is quite similar.
So you started getting, I guess, revisiting things, right? And weren't you running the same people over and over again? Was that how it got together with the folks?
The shows, those first two seasons, kind of struck a chord. I mean, you know, among our audience were people involved in the industry, let's say. And And so that opened doors more. That made it easier because it became our calling card. Mm-hmm. People knew, you know.
Hi, we're from Drugs Inc. Like, let the door swing wide for you. Yeah.
Well, there was one example which was caught on camera where a heroin dealer was being, we did a show in Baltimore, and this was actually in a suburb outside Baltimore, different jurisdiction, but local sheriffs were busting a guy. We were filming with them, and they bust a dealer on the street, and camera was there, and director approaches, do you mind if we film this? The guy's like hostile at first, no, you know, get that camera out of my face. And then the director says something about, oh, he's still giving him the spiel, you know, we're with National Geographic Television, we're making this documentary. And he said, well, Nat Geo, what, you guys Drugs Inc. or something? And the guy's director, of course, says, yeah, we are Drugs Inc. We're making a show about Baltimore. And he went, Drugs Inc., get out of here. That's my favorite show. This is all on camera, right? This was in the show. Wow. In the end. It's my favorite show. You guys did a show on Miami. It was right on the money. That was fantastic. Where do I sign? And he signed the release, and he gave us an interview.
Where do I sign?
While he's
spitting on cops. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he's handcuffed. Man. He's being, the cops are shining a torch in his eyes, see if he's high.
He's signing the paper.
And he gave a great interview, actually, you know, he was very friendly to us and really stoked to be approached by us, but also really quite regretful of his situation. And you could see that change across his face as he came to consider and reflect on his position. Mm. So it was a good moment. But it is kind of funny that you know, dealers know of our shows. Police, law enforcement also.
Yeah. And that helped you get to both of them, really, didn't it? As the show got more popular. I mean, the thing about, like, I remember being in the booth because I did the narration, if people didn't know. But it's one of those things where you had to get the police officer's unit name perfect, because that's their thing. You know, you have to say their unit right. You have to make sure you get all that stuff. And they were the guys that would give you the access to that side of it, right? I'm trying to think of, like, the right term. Was it on, like, a level where they told their cops what to do, like a, I guess a departmental level, or were you just going to, like, dudes that were?
Well, you have to go through a procedure, obviously, and it has to be sanctioned.
Yeah, so they sanctioned all that stuff.
There's a chain of command, and you know, and not everybody does. And I mean, I can tell you that overwhelmingly, as it were, you know, police on the street were always spoke very approvingly of the shows, but sometimes for all kinds of reasons, political reasons, whatever, it might not suit the brass to sanction filming at a given time.
Yeah.
So it didn't always come off. But you know, we were always grateful when we got the opportunity, because you know, the whole idea is to give everyone a fair shake.
Yeah, that's the thing I kind of took away from it being part of the show, because I'd get there. I mean, I'd get to the booth where the show was pretty much already done, and whoever had I guess directed the show, whoever's baby it was, had done like the rough narration, right? And it just seemed to me that it was so well balanced. You never see things so well balanced ever. Was that something you guys started to do from the outset?
Yes.
That was like the idea, right? Like, we're going to show exactly how it is. Yeah.
It's a 360 degree, you know, unvarnished portrait of the reality of the drug trade and its impact, and how it impacts on individuals caught up in it.
Yeah. Just looking at that dude reminds me, like you were saying, when you caught that dude in Baltimore who's the heroin dealer, say, right?
Yeah.
Let's call him heroin dealer number one, right?
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, Drugs Inc. And I guess in later shows, when people approach like dealers and cartel hitmen and things like that, they always seem to be like, yeah, you guys aren't faking, you know, you give us our side of the story. But when I the one thing I take away from is, a lot of times when you see people who are the junkies, the abusers of these drugs, right? And even some of the low-level dudes that's just doing this to get by kind of shit, mm-hmm. when they do get a mirror put in front of their face a lot of times, like that dealer, right? Mm-hmm. That you see this heavy remorse in them. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of funny where, you know, you don't see that anywhere else really in television. You don't see people actually coming to terms with who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, you try to in reality TV, but everybody's got like a little bit of a front going on. Mm-hmm. But when you're faced with a stark reality like that, mm-hmm. it just seemed like that was the big one. And like, how would you approach like a cartel to film in it? Would it be like, how did you get that guy, for instance, to talk? Was it the mask? Is that kind of the thing?
Well, the
because there were some fucking funny masks. And,
yeah.
And you did tell me a story that, like, you used to go to people's houses to film, and they'd have their own masks. They didn't want your shitty mask. They had, like, the Mardi Gras mask, yeah, not, like, just the...
Yeah. I mean, the masks came about. It was a kind of phase we went through. We actually, in the end, sort of jettisoned it because it was getting a little bit out of hand. But it emerged from the fact we did one of the kind of new, fresh spins we put on the shows... we moved from telling the story of a specific drug to the story of a specific city.
Yeah.
And then from there, we developed that to look at events in a city like New Year's Eve or Mardi Gras in the case of New Orleans, or July 4th in the case of Chicago. Why? Because that's the most violent weekend of the year consistently. And we figured there's got to be a reason for that. Consequently, you know, we were doing event-based shows, as it were, around a sort of ticking clock. There's a countdown to New Year's Eve, and, you know, is there, you know, everyone wants to party, everyone wants to get high. You know, how do the dealers react to that? Well, you know, you would then, you know, we then started, it sort of happened by accident that people were wearing masks, you know, because they were going to a party or it was Mardi Gras, or everyone wears masks. Yeah. And we thought it was a good look, and it was different from the bandanas and what have you normally see.
Yeah.
And so we went with it, but then it started, yeah, after a while it got old and we went back to bandanas. But and to answer your other question about cartels, I mean, cartels, particularly the Sinaloa cartel, which with whom we probably did most of our filming, not exclusively, but mainly in anything to do with Mexico. They're very centralized. They have a chain of command. It's quite military in a way. So any cartel operative we spoke to, that would have been cleared by his superior.
Really, fuck.
Yeah.
Isn't there a cartel that has had a military arm of all these ex-Special Forces dudes in Mexico, and then the Knights Templar, I think they are?
No, it's Los Zetas.
Yeah, and then they took over they took over from the guys who hired them. They're like, you guys are soft, boom.
Yeah, right? That's exactly, it's like something out of ancient Rome. You know? They were hired as a bodyguard, ex-Special Forces and military guys. The Los Zetas in Spanish, it means the zeros.
Mm.
And... It comes from the police radio call sign that their leader was given initially when he was still in Special Forces, and he was known as Z1.
Wow.
Or Z1, and that's where, so they became the Z's, or the Zetas. Wow. the Zeros, and their first, there were 30 of them initially, and it was literally Z1, Z1 through Z30. And that they were known by those, by
that. Like number seven, man.
And but the key point you raise is for me the heart of it, really, is what really makes these shows unique is you get to the dealers, you anonymize them so that nobody knows necessarily who they are. And then you get them to talk, and as they talk, I believe I've seen it many times in the shows, they start putting into words stuff they've never actually put into words before, thoughts and feelings and reflections. And the thing is about these drug dealers is, you know, they're not monsters, they're not animals, they're human beings, and they're not stupid either. You know, that they may not have had the breaks in terms of schooling or education or whatever, but they are not stupid, and they know what they're doing, and they understand the implications of what they're doing, and quite often they're conflicted about it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think everybody kind of thinks that, I guess before drugs, they thought there was like a drug dealer type of human, like this kind of like zombie, you know, Terminator kind of mentality, that they just went out and sold drugs, fuck everybody kind of vibe.
Yeah.
But then when I started doing the show, that was like, that was the first thing that struck me. It was like, these people are like as human as anybody, you know, if even more so, because when they're confronted with you know, I guess themselves, when they have the mask on, they're allowed to say things that they, I guess they wouldn't allow themselves to think or say when they didn't have their mask.
Certainly not share.
Yeah, definitely not share. That's the thing. It's also, you know, when you talk about cartels and things like that, you know, yeah, they're the guys like, you know, El Chapo and people like that, and, you know, the hitmen who are like the seriously hard guys. But then I learned as you go down the chain, there's like, you know, they're like moms and stuff like that just happen to be, you know, in a position where they have to keep stuff in their garage or the house get blown up or something, because you don't have a lot of options, especially if you're in certain parts of the world. And like, we're lucky in the Western world. We have certain options we can get away with, but you get out of Mexico and even different parts of, you know, like Central America and things like that, it's very different, man. Life is cheap, man.
But, you know, even in the United States, you know, if you're from a certain background and you're from a certain neighborhood, your options are really limited.
Yeah, it was Biggie Small said that, you know, you can play ball, you better have a wicked jump shot or sell the crack rock. You know what I'm saying?
True that.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about was when the show first started, right? You guys were given, was it like a, because I guess Nat Geo was one of those networks, right, that tries to inform and teach and like tell people about the world, right? Mm-hmm. I thought the fact that Drugs Inc. was on there, it's a cable network, right? So like all these people that have, like all the drug dealers that watch it, they got cable. So they can't be that bad off, right? But the network was behind it for the longest time. And I remember like when it started ending, people were like, the people who were running the network were like, yeah, you know, we know it kind of, it's I know it's the highest rated show, but like we just, it's, you know, I was it the politically correct nature of television kind of pushing it out even though people liked it?
It was part of something much bigger.
Yeah.
You know, Nat Geo are changing their whole style. And Drugs Inc. was part of a previous style. So they, you know, they're now going for really big, very ambitious, very high level projects that deal with very big subjects, you know, like human colonization of Mars or the nature of genius or, you know, and much more kind of cerebral topics and a show which kind of unpicks the anthropology of essentially street crime.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't fit with that look. Yeah. And hey, you know, channels do that. They rebrand themselves, they refresh the brand, just like we did as a series. We changed and, you know, always gave it a fresh angle every year, if, you know, as best we could. So there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we ran for 8 years.
I'm not giving them a bad rap, but the thing that I kind of noticed was, like, people still hit me up on the social media all the time. Oh, what's up with Drugs Inc.? Yo, what's up with Drugs Inc.? And it's like, yo, you got 8 seasons to watch Drugs Inc., but now it's on Netflix as well, which is a great thing. Mm. And do you think it'll gonna have a resurgence of, like, I don't know, what kind of TV show would you call Drugs Inc. if you had to call it? Like a Drugs Inc. TV show?
Yeah, I mean, it's a true crime documentary, but there are a lot of shows deal with true crime, but there's nothing like this. It's unique. Mm.
I mean, I know as a guy, just as a dude, like after doing like a lot of these shows, I come out of the vocal booth and just be like, holy shit, man. Like I rarely mess with drugs, but now I totally don't even, because you see all the bad sides. Like, you know, people say, you know, okay, I'm going to, what was that dude, the dude in the Bronx who had those kind of like weird drinks that he'd make with a bunch of different liquors, what are they called, Knuckles?
You got me there.
Those were great, man.
Yeah.
But like that guy was the only dude that didn't have a supply chain that shat all over the human race. But everybody else, you see, like, you know, for instance, like the story of the cocaine, where you got a farmer somewhere in Peru, and he's got nothing, and he sells what he's got, and that's still nothing, and just get him to the next week, you know. And then it starts getting, you know, the key, right? The keys kept getting more expensive as you went through cross borders, and then when you get from, what was it, like something like $12 or something like that in Peru to 35,000 or something like that when you get on the street.
Yeah,
that's the thing I took away from it. How much drugs affects people who don't do them, you know. And I think that's something that lesson cannot be given. You know,
enough.
I think that like that's a thing that people forget about, and it's uncomfortable. But that's kind of the way the world is, and if you're always in your comfort zone, you're never going to learn anything, right?
Yeah, that's true. And you know, I mean, hopefully we might be able to do something like it again, but I just don't know.
And we did, Underworld Inc., right?
Yeah.
That was great. That was some crazy shit. We talked about organs getting vicked out of people and yep. stuff. Well,
yeah, it was black market. The same approach to you know, drugs are a big part of the black market, but there are other things move in the black market too. Yeah. We just started looking at other areas of black market and activity, you know, the trafficking of, you know, contraband of one kind or another. So it was a natural step, really, to broaden out to that, and it did okay. It was good.
Do you think cartels are like the, I guess, are they the free enterprise of the 21st century?
They certainly quite consciously borrow from the methods, the strategies used by big business, you know. So again, they're clever dudes.
That guy El Chapo, I mean, he had so many. I mean, he was escaping from jails with tunnels built under the jails. Everybody knew what was going on. I mean, for somebody saying, "Oh, I didn't know they were building a tunnel under the prison," you're full of shit. you know that was there. Yeah.
It's a massive construction. Yeah. Huge, fantastic piece of precision engineering.
Well, yeah, like it wasn't like the Great Escape or anything.
No, and you know, you build the thing. It's got air conditioning, electric lighting, and even a sort of railway track.
Yeah, the motorcycle and the rail track.
On it. I mean, that's it's for one use only.
Yeah.
The whole thing, one use.
Just to get the dude out.
Just
man.
To get one guy out, and then that's it, abandoned. And I mean, if you're dealing with that kind of infrastructure and that ability to organize, you know, you're dealing with something very, very major.
You know, I also find a lot of countries aside from Mexico, like, that could never happen with us. We're not that, you know, we couldn't be that corrupt. But in reality, Mexico is just bad at hiding it. You know what I mean? It's like every other country's got so much nefarious things going on underground, behind the scenes, that, you know, I don't think people want to know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They just, like, they wouldn't want to think that shit's happening in the UK or in the US or anywhere. But it is, man. It is. And I think, in a lot of ways, I think the fact that the drugs thing is kind of, it transcends borders and all that kind of stuff, right? But yeah. It's also one of those things where it's a microcosm how everybody operates, man. You know, that's the thing I took away from it as well. Like, you know, you see all these smart people with limited opportunity that somehow make it work, right? And, you know, I mean, growing up where I grew up, I always saw a lot of drugs and things like that. And that's one of the reasons I didn't do heavy drugs, because you see a heroin addict nodding out, and that person was fine 2 weeks before, a crack addict who just completely fell off. But I think Drugs Inc. probably helped a generation of people to not go down that road of drug abuse, right? I mean, they should give you a fucking medal for that, man.
Well, thank you. Absolutely. If we, or at least
an OBE or something.
if we stop somebody going down that road, then we've done our job, really. Because I mean, we're certainly not glamorizing drugs. We show it as it is, and you draw your own conclusions.
No, we used to sit there while we were doing the takes, and in between takes, we're like, holy moly, and we'd have our own little running commentary, and I always thought that would be funny, like, you know, if you had the box set of drugs, saying, the shit Chris and Huey talk about, and our boy Luke, you know, our engineer, like, the shit we talk about while sipping that coffee before I went in the box. It was great stuff, man. I'd love that show.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I think, especially now, we're like the whole idea. I think I touched on it a little before, the idea of comfortability. You know, people want to, they don't want to watch stuff that makes them uncomfortable, but mm-hmm. they kind of do anyway. Mm-hmm. It's almost like that car wreck kind of situation where they see a car wreck, they're like, don't want to watch it, but they end up kind of slowing down and looking out the window. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, they feel bad that they slowed down and looked out the window, but they'll tell all their friends about what happened. Mm-hmm. I guess that's a kind of an idea of what's going on with drugs in this society today. I mean, because all they got stuff like that, all that synthetic mm-hmm. opiate stuff. What is that, like fentanyl and OxyContin and things like that?
Well, opiates, yeah. I mean, yeah. The pharmaceutical opiates are kind of responsible for being a trigger for the heroin that follows, because when there was a crackdown on getting hold of the pharma-grade opiates, the pills and what have you, then, you know, cartels are right there.
They're holding up the bag of heroin, just like this, man.
Yeah.
And you don't have to shoot it in your veins. Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't have to use the needle, exactly.
There's a dude I talked to who's a doctor. He's a doctor in the UK, but he's also a guitar dude. And he had this thing where he was working for the Churchill Foundation. Mm. And he went to jails in the United States. I think he did it was 8 weeks or 10 weeks or something like that. And he was the doctor that saw the inmates when they first came in when they were DTing. So he had within a couple minutes figure out what kind of drugs they were on, how to treat them, and also, you know, just try to be a human being to them, because a lot of times, you know, when you get put in the system like that and you're a drug arrest, it's not good for you, you know. And I did a pod with him, and the one thing that struck me was he's 95% of them were black. And it was weird, because I know we got some static from Drugs Inc. And I don't know if you did you tell me about it? Someone told me about it, where people are like, oh, you're just targeting minorities on the show. It's like, no, we're not targeting minorities on the show. I think I said it. I think it's just that it's not racist to show what racism does to people. Mm. And that's kind of the story that no one gets. They're always willing to be triggered, going, oh, all you do is show black people and brown people dealing drugs. Like, no. Society has worked it so only black people and brown people get arrested for this shit. And that's kind of, you know, the thing that that I guess strikes a certain chord with me that I don't think people really got from Drugs Inc. There wasn't kind of, you weren't exploiting a certain part of society. You were showing society that society's exploiting those people, you know?
We were holding a mirror.
Yeah. And that, sometimes that's the hardest thing to watch, right?
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, even beyond that, I mean, the whole drug thing is kind of, it's a tragedy, really. And I think you kind of feel that. And tragedy, as we know, is a key part of drama. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, Shakespeare made his name on it.
Yeah.
It is the thing that drives our storytelling. And, you know, as a species, we're into storytelling. So yeah. TV is a great medium for conveying the emotion that underlies the kind of tragedy of the human condition. And drugs illustrates that, and the drug trade illustrates that in the modern world, you know, possibly more than anything else. Mm. And, you know, it's wrong. It shouldn't happen. It traps people. It confirms people in a trap that they're already in. We talked about ethnic minorities kind of branded, you know, and therefore only as it were allowed that opportunity. Mm. And yeah. You know.
Did you ever go and direct any of these shows?
I did pick up shoots. Yeah, I've been out in the.
What was the strangest thing that ever happened on one of those shoots?
On the first season, I picked up, tagged along with police, and we were doing cocaine and crack busts
with police.
So we were filming. So we were filming with police, and There's a whole thing, you know, you can't, when you go in with police on a search and seizure operation, so they're going on to private property,
yeah.
They, under the terms of the warrant issued by the judge, are allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. But you, as a journalist or, as a filmmaker, cannot just assume you have the same rights of
well, yeah, you can't go on the property, right?
Going on the property, you know, you can't just rock up and invade someone's privacy. Police have authority from a judge to do that, and it's special. Privacy is guarded jealously, and property rights are guarded jealously, and police have to get a warrant specific to yeah. that address at that time to go in for this reason, this yeah. probable cause, and you are not a police officer. You're a guy with a camera, so. The way you have to do it is they go in first, and weirdly, they have to negotiate with the person, the people in the property, to say, is it okay if the camera crew comes in? And then those people, if they say yes, have to sign a piece of paper.
And then all this is happening while they're getting...
While they're getting busted.
Oh, shit.
In fact, what happened in this case was I was kind of... it was a kind of double whammy, really, because I was hovering on the outskirts of the property. They went in and were arresting people and searching and doing their thing, and I was approached by a guy in shirt sleeves and a tie. He looked like a business guy, and he said, "Are you the National Geographic film crew?" And I said, yeah, wondering what's going to happen here. Is this an aggrieved neighbour who doesn't want the neighbourhood to be shown?
Probably thought I was going to go down the toilet, man, yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. And he said, oh, thank goodness you're here. I'm from the property company that leases this house. These guys have been squatting for months. We've been trying to get them out. And I'm just so glad you're here. Where do I sign?
Oh, shit.
So he gave me, and he said, anything you want, you've got full access, you can go in, I'm delighted, you film it all, you show them being removed, I want wow. that. So that was pretty unexpected. And then, so I went in and was filming police, and then the guys were all laid out on the floor, and they all had the cable ties on and so on, and I was kind of hovering, thinking, well, I need to ask them, is it okay? Can I get a release to film them as well?
Excuse me, you over there on the floor,
yeah,
handcuffed.
You on the floor, yeah, handcuffed, is it okay? And this big SWAT guy comes over in full tack gear with his mask on and everything, you know, and just says, and I've got the piece of paper in my hand, and he says, is that the release? And I said, yes, it is. He says, give it here, grabs it from my hand. Goes over to these guys and said, this guy's from National Geographic, he's filming for worldwide broadcast, sign here. They thought it was hilarious.
Oh, really?
They all cracked up, and they just thought it was so
did
funny.
They sign, though?
They signed.
They signed it, though, hey, man.
And they signed, and it was, but it was like, oh, you've got to take these off me.
Yeah, for two, I could sign.
Sign. And then they said, you try and run, you're in trouble. And he says, I won't run. And they did, and oh, he did man. Sign. So it was okay.
Were there ever dudes that incriminated themselves on, like, other crimes while they were talking to the camera? Because we used to sit there and go, why would these guys... I mean, I understand it's TV and everybody wants to be on TV. I mean, look at fucking Britain's Got Talent and shit like that. Everybody be on TV for whatever. But these guys, obviously, the drug dealers, I guess... I did hear a story from you that, like, dudes that knew each other would try to outdo each other on Drugs Inc.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
being braggers.
There's a degree of that. As I say, I think people took part for a bunch of reasons, and the reason that might be their trigger might be as they got into it. Then it might change as they got more reflective, as I was saying. So yeah, sometimes it was like, I saw those guys last week, blah blah blah. You know, listen, they ain't dealers. I'm a dealer. Yeah. Let me tell you. So yeah. there's certainly a bit of that, but as I say, I mean, the point is that a lot of the time, these guys, nobody really listens to them. Mm. Nobody's interested in what they have to say, what they think of.
Anything,
the
right?
Price of fish. Yeah. They and we come along. We come along with our English accents, so that makes us.
But that helped you guys. Like, didn't that help you like immensely?
Oh, absolutely. Because we're kind of rare animals, you know, in the hood.
It's, well, I mean, it's also they see white dudes or whatever. They see dudes, and they're like, "Well, this could be cops." And then you start speaking, they're like, "These guys aren't fucking cops."
Yeah. Right away, they know you cannot be part of the game.
Yeah.
Because that your voice gives it away. Mm-hmm. But you also our whole approach. Here is, you know, you just show them common respect and decency, you know, and you build trust that way, and you kind of, you know, at first they don't necessarily know what to make of you, and they might be suspicious, they might be a bit hostile, but that breaks down over time, and they realize you are genuine and you're being transparent, and you're not, you know, you're not copying an attitude, you're not working an angle, and you just. And you're interested in what they want to say, and that's rare. And then once they get going, they I think stuff starts coming out.
It's therapeutic, right?
I mean, absolutely therapeutic. That is the word. That is the word. I'm sure of it. That, you know, the mask helps because they can really.
They could be a little anonymous, and they're
anonymous, and they can really just open up. And it's stuff they wouldn't tell their you know, their associates, their gang. Bangers,
you can't be insightful and sensitive to another guy in the cartel,
or confess, you know, your the conflict that you have, or just, you know, sometimes stuff comes out which you just don't anticipate as well, because everyone has an image, as you were saying, of what a drug dealer is and what motivates them and what kind of mindset they have. And I'll give you, for instance, we're interviewing a guy in East LA. Who his job was to pick up from consignments from stash houses, and then drop them around to, you know, regular customers. So he'd literally drive around the city all day, and he was always on the move, and he was always picking up. And in the middle of the interview, his cell rings, and he cameras keeps rolling. He says, "Oh, excuse me, I'll just take this." And no, first thing he says when the phone rings is he gives you the one-liner that you expect a dealer to say. He says, "When I hear that sound, that's money talking."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Great bite for TV. We'll have that. Takes the call, you know, a few grunts. And, okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah, right. Puts it down. And then he says, "You know what? Just once, I wish that phone would ring for me. But it never does. It only rings when people want something from me." And I fell on the ground when I heard that. Because then it suddenly told you that this tough guy, this is all front, mm-hmm. underneath, he's actually just a 19-year-old, and he's lonely.
Yeah, he's sitting in a car all day and driving around drugs. It doesn't make for, I guess, good communities where you have, like, especially all these young kids that are trying to hide how they feel, to be certain, to fit into certain molds and stuff. Like, even, I mean, obviously, I was in East LA too. I think I remember that dude. Hey, were there any, like, I think you remember telling me about. One time a camera crew got their shit stolen, and then some dude who was above the dudes that stole the shit were like, "Yo, you give that shit back." And they did. Tell me that story. It's fucking crazy.
Do you know, I can't really remember the detail of it too much. We didn't really have much.
Yeah, there wasn't much bad shit happening, was there?
No, not much.
But isn't that because people knew the show and the reputation of the show, and they said, like, you know, they're not going to screw us over. They're actually going to let us talk.
Yeah.
You know, because they're not going to be like, "All right, now shut up. Here's what the cops say." Yeah. You know, that's important.
And we got that a lot, a sort of a burning, you know, a real kind of passion about, you know, people don't know what it's like. It's not like the movies. We'd hear this all the time. It's not like the movies. It's not like on TV. People don't know what it's like. And they were desperate to convey what it's like. And what it's like is chaos. Their lives. We did one show. We were following a dealer in Atlanta. His story was, whatever goal he set himself that day, he never could achieve, because something came out of left field and just knocked him aside. Some shit came along he had to deal with.
Yeah.
And that was his tragedy. He could never actually achieve anything that he wanted to.
Yeah.
Can you imagine living your life like that? It's the stress of that, the frustration of it. You know, anything he wanted, whatever it was, he couldn't do because the phone went and he had to go sort something out.
Yeah. I think that's what was the, for me, like you were talking about the human condition, that's the it's probably one of the best shows that illustrate that. You know, because it is, you see a lot of people, individuals, right, that are working for either the police department or some bad guys or whatever, and those little things are things like, holy shit, like that dude in particular, and the guy who's the mule in East L.A., and it goes all over. There was a guy, was it an Australian dude that we had to redo it because he got straight and he got a job? Mm-hmm. Remember that dude? We had to pixelate his face, and I had to come back in and do the stuff. We had to call him a different name and shit, because at first he was like, I'm a junkie, fuck it. Mm-hmm. And then he was like, you know, I pulled myself out of the gutter, and, you know, I would rather this not go out. And the fact that you guys were cool about that, I mean, most TV shows would be like, you know, fuck you. You know, you signed that release. You know, we're putting this out there, and your well-being be damned.
And we maintain contact. You see, we don't. You know, when the filming's done or the show goes out, we check up on folks, just see where they're at, how it's going. You know,
because that's obviously how you are as a dude, right? I mean, it's not like if there was someone else there aside from you, it probably wouldn't have been as cool as that. I always found you being a very, I guess, an even guy when it comes to like the good, the yin and the yang of the drug zinc thing. Even when we did the underworld thing, it's kind of like, yeah, those are the cops, yeah, those are the bad guys, but we're all human beings. I think that was the important balance, I think, that struck that show and made it so successful, really.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, I think it's just the way that there's more of a chance of that happening because we're British.
Yeah.
Based, I mean, there's in the British TV culture, there's more kind of care devoted to the folks. I mean, I'm not saying 100%.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt Simon Cowell actually gives a fuck.
Somebody's yeah. you know going to feel that they've been badly treated by TV, and you know, I'm sure with justification, you know, but the intention is there, the culture from which we're drawn, the professional culture from which we're drawn is much more inclined to that. So I wouldn't sort of put it all on me. Just, you know, if there was somebody else in my shoes, it would be different. No, I don't think it would be necessarily.
Well, that's good of you to say. I mean, it kind of illustrates my point. Now, how'd you get into TV anyway? Because I know that you were a musician. You're a hella bass player. And now you're a drummer, apparently, right?
Yeah. Did I tell you that?
Yeah, you told me that, but you can't get into going to the drums now.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I'm a drummer. It helps me with my timing.
It helps me as a musician, actually, enormously, learning how to play drums. Drums is it. Yeah. I mean, anybody thinks drummers are animals, forget it.
I'm seeing Frank on the weekend playing a gig, so I'll tell him, like, you know, not everybody thinks you're an animal, Frank.
No, absolutely. Because he's not playing an instrument, he's playing an orchestra.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. You know, I mean, every limb is doing something different, right?
It is, and you've got to think about that, and you've got to make a decision about why you're doing that.
Yeah, that's the thing. As many people give drummers a hard time, right, at least they are decisive. That's the thing. They don't lay back and go, man, man, man. They'll do something, good or bad, but they'll do something.
Yeah.
So anyway, how did you get into TV?
So, well, I was playing a rock band. This will date me. So I was playing in a rock band. It was a straight-ahead, three-piece guitar rock. Mm-hmm. That's what we did.
Power trio, man. Power trio. I'm in one.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, the drummer that we had, who I went to school with, was a guy called Mel Gaynor, who went on later to join a band called Simple Minds. He did all right, Mel, which is great because he's a fantastic musician and a really, really nice guy. And for a nice guy to finish first in the music industry,
yeah, that's rare.
That fills my heart with joy every time I think of it.
Cool.
Because he's a great guy. But so we were doing this band, and then punk came along. And suddenly, we were just getting record company interest, and we were doing our own stuff. We were recording demos and stuff. We were playing, doing a lot of live work. That wasn't a problem. Mm. But record interest suddenly just fell away, unless we became punks. And we weren't really wanting to do that.
Yeah, yeah. See, the thing is, a lot of people think that everybody became a punk back in those days. They didn't.
No.
There was only a small bunch of punks, and they didn't really.
It was tiny, and in my personal opinion, it was manufactured by the music press.
Yeah.
Mainly because they were having falling circulation figures, right? And they needed something. And they generated it, and eventually it took off, but it needed a heck of a lot of help.
Oh yeah, they were infusing a lot of money into that. I mean,
otherwise it would have died the death. So we kind of fell apart as a band, or we decided to go our separate ways, and I was at a loose end, and I heard about this training scheme that the BBC ran for research assistants. And I hadn't watched a TV for about 4 years, you know, so I thought, well, I better. So I bought myself a little black and white TV set, off a market stall, and started watching TV and kind of filled out the forms and got asked for an interview and managed to kind of say whatever I said. I can't remember now, but it was pretty hardcore. There were like three interviews, and then you had to write something like a script or something and come up
with
an
idea. It sounds like nowadays too. You got to show them everything that you could possibly do, and then they'll think about it. You know?
Yeah, and then it was for a training attachment, they called it. So you got like 2 weeks of intensive training, and then you were let loose on working on programs, but it was only like a 1 year contract. Mm. At the end of that time, you had to get your apply again.
Oh.
So you'd be looking for jobs coming up inside the BBC, and I was lucky to get taken up, and not everybody did on this course. There were people who got to the end, and there was no job for them, and that was in the late 70s. So. BBC is very different now and does it all very differently, I'm sure. But it was pretty cool. That's how I got into TV.
What were the kind of shows that you were doing research for? Anything interesting?
I did a wide variety of things. I mean, initially, because you move from thing to thing to thing.
Because they're trying to find you, yeah.
It's not only you're finding what you're into, but also it's just to get the experience.
Yeah.
So I did all kinds of stuff, which, you know, long ago, 35 years ago, so long, long forgotten. But the first, I got involved in the first kind of generation of what were known as youth programs. So this is in the very early 80s, so it's Thatcher years, and, you know, a lot of stuff going down. And we were making documentaries, but aimed at a sort of teenage or young adult audience. So they were a little more hip than the standard sort of documentaries at the time. And just looking at it from youth perspectives. So we were doing shows on racism at the time that the Brixton riots happened. We were doing, you know, protests over the whole CND. Thing going on at the time, you know, of Greenham Common and the anti-Trident and cruise missile protests. So, you know, at the time, 100,000 people marched through the centre of London. We were doing unemployment at the time, the right to work marches were happening. Mm-hmm. Animal rights, we did a thing which turned me into a vegetarian.
Wow. How long have you been a vegetarian since then?
Since mid 80s, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Was that powerful, huh?
Yeah, it was strangely, I mean, I was kind of moved by the argument that which is known as speciesism, which is like a kind of racism but applied to the treatment of different species, if you can treat that you're on the treatment of animals, which are, after all, sentient beings that can feel pain,
mm-hmm.
and can apprehend pain. That's the thing, that they're aware. You know, an animal being led to slaughter knows something bad is going to happen, and that apprehension of that fear of what's coming is a definition of sentience, of being self-aware, mm-hmm. right? And if you can treat animals in battery farming, that we know they've been treated. Again, I don't want to comment on practices now. This was 30 plus years ago. But, you know, at that time, it was widely documented that battery farming was pretty horrific in terms of treatment of animals. Yeah. That's on the same road as Auschwitz.
Yeah.
You know, if you can psych yourself to treat sentient beings that way, on the basis that they're somehow lesser than you.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You end up.
Oh, I see that line. Yeah,
you end up at Auschwitz, and I was kind of moved by that. I thought, well, that the logic of that. Yeah, I get that. But I was mainly out of self-interest, you could say. I was kind of moved by. I interviewed a guy called Mark Gold, who'd written a book about the way in which animals in the food industry were fed on sort of growth promoters, hormones, antibiotics, all those additives. And I just thought, you know what, that's what you're pumping into your body, and it's going to reduce your ability to deal. It's going to hit your immune system. If you're imbibing small amounts of antibiotics all the time through the meat you eat, you know, your system is going to be less resistant to stuff. And I gave up meat, and I didn't have a cold for 3 years.
You know, I was talking to Ricky Gervais on one of these pods, and he's I don't know if he's vegan. I don't know if he's vegetarian. Are you vegan or vegetarian?
I'm vegetarian. I can't quite make the final link. But I mean, hey, with the growth of, you know, I don't have a problem with soya and actually even GM, because farmers and horticulturalists have been modifying plants for thousands of years.
It seems like, that's kind of, it's more in the mainstream now than it was back when you were doing the show about it, right?
Yeah,
there
exactly.
weren't vegans or vegetarians.
It was very, very rare. You know, there was crap.
There were real people and there were weirdos, right? That's how they looked at it, right? Exactly. It was really like, if you don't eat meat, you're a weirdo.
You couldn't buy soya products in the supermarket, you know, like you can now. Or not soy, if you don't like soy, you know, you've got hemp or you've got milk, you know, rice milk or oat milk.
I had a girl that was vegetarian, and I remember she got me like a turkey sandwich from someplace, right? And I'm eating the turkey sandwich, great, right? It's like, hey, you know, that's not really a turkey sandwich. I was like, well, whatever it is, it's good. And it was like soy or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, and that was like the early 90s. I just got out of the Marines. So it was like, you know, it was just starting to kick it in New York.
Yeah.
When did all that stuff kind of, I mean, especially with, I guess, all the vegetarianism. I think the United Kingdom was kind of like on the cutting edge of that stuff, though, in the early 80s.
Yeah, it was definitely around in the 80s. Yeah, it was, certainly. I mean, I found it not too difficult to be, you know, it wasn't like suddenly, my God, what am I going to eat?
You weren't just sitting there eating vegetables. You were getting protein from places and things like that.
Yeah, and there were vegetarian cookbooks and stuff you could get. It's true. It wasn't widely available like in restaurants and stuff. And vegan, though, that was really...
See, I don't really know what vegan means. That's just difficult. Nothing that was alive. You don't eat... Well, you can eat plants because...
No animal products whatsoever.
Okay, not even eggs and things like that.
Not eggs, not dairy.
No fish.
Cheese, fish, nothing. And also in baking as well, because obviously if they've used, you know, butter or anything like that or animal fat of any kind. So there's no animal fat in anything you eat. So you're going to be, you know, nuts, fruits, veg, nuts, pulses.
So you did this show back in the day, and it kind of got you into this idea, right? Did any other shows that you worked on kind of have the same effect on you?
Well, the other one would be, which is the same period actually in the 80s, was I devised a show called Rock School, which
is before all the Jack Black movies,
which is possibly why Jack Black's movie was called School of Rock and not Rock School.
Because there was a copyright on it?
There was a copyright on it. BBC trademarked that name, as I understand it. So, but the idea was, I just took my experiences of learning to play in a band and thought, well, nobody's ever really done anything on TV. TV would seem like a good medium for conveying our kind of slogan was the techniques, the technology, and the musical vocabulary you need to play in a band, no matter what the style or instrument. Okay, that was our ambition.
That's a big brush, man. That's pretty cool, though.
We did 13 shows, and we got there. We got a long way down the road to doing it. And the idea was how to play in a band, really. And we looked at, first series looked at guitar, bass, and drums, and how they work together to produce different styles of music. Starting with real basics, so tuning, you know, and stuff.
Stuff that people don't know how to do nowadays anyway. Yeah, I've heard some shit that's not even in tune, man. Yeah,
exactly. And this is, let's say this is 1983, and it was a studio-based show, and I found these musicians who could play lots of different styles and kind of put them together as a kind of studio band, and they're the presenters of the show, and they're demonstrating there, and they devised a whole bunch of small licks and chunks of portions of songs or chunks of riffs or whatever to play together to illustrate different aspects of style, how the bass and the drums might fit together, but also there's techniques involved, so string bending and hammering on and pulling off and stuff like that, use of pedals and effects. But then we intercut that with a whole bunch of interviews with anyone who talked to me in the world of rock. So we got an amazing contribution from a whole range of top players. So in sort of bass, which is my instrument, we got Bootsy Collins.
Damn.
John Entwistle.
Oh, wow.
Larry Graham.
Larry Graham, yeah, you know, best in the world, right?
A guy called Lee Rocker.
He was in Stray Cats, man.
Yeah, absolutely, in the Stray Cats.
Upright,
and he came in and demonstrated slap bass, right? And which he did.
Did he climb on the bass? I love that.
He did the whole thing and he nailed it. He was great.
He was in a band, I think it was him and the drummer, was it? And then Earl Slick, the guitar player, used to play with Bowie. Was it Rocker, Slick, something Rocker and Slick? And it was, whoever's listening to this, Google me. Google it and let me know, man. Yeah, so it seems like with that show, right, it seems like a lot of stuff that you do, you have to be personally connected with, right? Is that how you go about doing your professional stuff?
You asked me the standouts.
Yeah,
obviously, well, in between, there are lots of others. Yeah, but yeah. What I try and do is find a personal connection, yes. If you don't get excited by what you're doing, it will show.
Yeah.
The viewers get it. The TV is incredibly filmmaking, whatever you call it. It's an incredibly organic thing, and it's very human. And people see so much, and they're so attuned to the nuances of it that if there's boredom in what you've done, it will convey.
Yeah, yeah, that's so true, man.
And it must be in music too.
So. Oh yeah, I mean it exactly the same way too. If you know, we hear so much crappy music and we see so much crappy TV, then when we see something that's actually not crappy, we take real notice of it. But I was always of the school of, like, life is too short to listen to shitty music. Life is too short to watch shitty TV, right? Yeah. And the way to do that is actually when you find something that you connect with. Yeah. You know, as you said, people are very attuned to things. They can smell bullshit a mile off.
Yeah.
So, especially, you know, the shows that people are into making are the ones that are going to rise above the ones that they have to make. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because what was it? A lot of famous actors do shitty movies so they can make four shitty movies so they can make the one they want to make.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of why a lot of people do things like that.
Yeah, but the trick is, I find anyway, is you've always got to find something that excites you that you can connect with.
Yeah.
So whatever the topic, the subject is, or whatever it is you're having to do, you've got to find the thing that presses your button that you go, wow, okay, I can get with this.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, you don't want to make boring stuff. You don't want people to share your boy. You know, that's not a way to be.
I hear you, and that's I guess that's how you are as a dude. That's how I am as a dude.
Yeah,
I know I guess a lot of people who just do shit because they have to do it, right? Yeah. And like, you know, you can do that if you choose to, but that's why I work with you, is because you don't choose to do stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, and you kind of owe it to them.
Yeah,
you know, don't just go through the motions. You know,
well,
it's
I think
creative industry.
Yeah.
Create.
Yeah, exactly. And also, people do have a contempt for audience, and I don't know where that comes from. It happens in music. It happens in television. Everywhere, like people don't like the people that like them. It's terrible, man. I don't get it. It's some kind of weird thing in the society today where we're
Freud.
Kind of, yeah, exactly. Well, dude, I appreciate you sitting and talking with me, though, man. I think we got a whole bunch of stuff. Oh, shit, we got like an hour, bro. Damn. Right on, Chris. Well, hey, dude, I hope to see you soon, man. Good catching up with you, brother.
pretty awesome, huh? I'm glad I got to share some of the craziness with you. It's seriously an education narrating that show. Now, in case you missed it, you can catch Drugs Inc. on Netflix. It's all over the place. So, okay, next week we got a doozy for you. You know how I like to share my behind-the-scenes connections? Well, I feel this dude might be one of the ultimate behind-the-scene kind of guys. Now, I met him recently while driving a Lamborghini around London, and he was my chaperone. And maybe you've heard of a show he worked on. It's something called Top Gear. Yes, my friends, next week on Huey Off the Record, it's race and stunt driver Ben Collins, also known as The Stig. Yeah, it's an awesome episode. You don't want to miss it, so make sure you don't. And get yourself subscribed and on your favorite podcast app like iTunes or Acast. They're just waiting for you, friends. Until then, y'all stay classy.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.